Hey, everybody. Welcome to Just for Variety. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Today is February 1st, 2023. My first guest this week is Jay Shetty. The self-help guru and New York Times bestselling author has just released his new book, 8 Rules of Love, How to Find It, Keep It, and Let It Go. The host of the Health and Wellness podcast On Purpose talks to me about love and romance, officiating Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck's wedding, and why he thinks The Notebook is an unhealthy depiction of romance. Then later in the show, Ben Aldridge. The British actor is here for a chat about his new movie, the M. Night Shyamalan thriller, Knock at the Cabin. Aldridge also gets emotional while talking about the moment he came out as gay with an Instagram post not even 3 years ago. But before I get to Shetty and Aldridge, let's take a look at this week's Just for Variety column. It's not every day that an action movie stars an 80-year-old. But leave it to octogenarian Harrison Ford to return as Indiana Jones in Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, the fifth installment of the iconic franchise. While moviegoers may be surprised to see Ford return 4 decades after making the first film, the actor has long felt he'd be back. "I always wanted to do it," he told me at the premiere of his Apple TV Plus comedy series Shrinking. "I wanted to do the rest of the story to see the end of his career." But even Ford has his limits. He insists he's hung up Indy's fedora and bullwhip for good. "It's the last time for me," he said. Welcome back to Just for Variety. I'm talking to Jay Shetty. The former monk is a New York Times bestselling author and host of On Purpose, a health and wellness podcast. He has earned a major Hollywood following, so much so that he officiated Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck's wedding in August. And now Shetty has released his new book, 8 Rules of Love, How to Find It, Keep It, and Let It Go. We caught up over Zoom from his home in Los Angeles, and wait till you hear what he has to say about The Notebook.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I love how right on time you are. You're amazing. Oh,
of course, of course. I could have really been looking forward to this. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Me too. What a great book, man.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That means the world. Thank you for making the time. That's the best thing an author can hear is that. So thank you.
It's a book I needed. It's a book I need. I know about heartbreak. I know about trying to find love, not finding love, falling out of love, falling in love, grief, healing. I think the last time we spoke, we were on the carpet and we were talking about shame. So I guess my first question for you is like, where did the book come from? Why did you think, you know what, this needs to be told? I need to help people in this area.
Yeah, there were a few things. First of all, I just want to point out how sharp you look, even on Zoom.
Oh,
I'm impressed. You look good on the carpet, but I'm very impressed. Sorry, I got distracted, but I'll get back. So there were a few reasons. The first is I think that I've always been personally obsessed with love and romance. I'm fascinated by it. And I've made so many mistakes in relationships. I've personally had so many challenges and everything you just explained just now. And when I write a book, I think about what do I want to be immersed in for the next 2 to 3 years? Because I know it's going to take that much research and reading and interviewing and learning and speaking to people who've been dating for 3 dates and people who've been married for 3 decades. Like, that was the work that went into the book. And what came out of it, Mark, that really stood out to me, which is why this book I felt I had to write, was that I was meeting people who were having success in their career, they were having success financially, they were having success in their professional lives, but because they didn't have a partner, because they didn't have love, or their home life was detrimental or full of pressure and stress, they actually were feeling incomplete, inadequate, and unfulfilled. And at the same time, Mark, I saw the opposite, where someone may not have had their professional life together, but because they had their love life together, they felt a certain strength and confidence and hope that they could figure things out. And so I could clearly see that the quality of love in our lives was a key indicator as to the quality of our entire lives. But guess what? We never learned how to love at school. We don't really talk about it openly enough, about the challenges and the issues in a healthy way to grow. And at the same time, it seems like career and success kind of trumps love and joy and these words that feel softer and less important. And so for all those reasons, I wanted love to be plastered all over the world. And that's why we even chose the cover that we did, because I wanted everyone to feel, see, and experience love, even if they didn't read the book.
Listen, we know, you know, there've been, we probably can never count how many books there are about love, how many advice columns, talks, apps. What makes this book the book that, listen, no one's ever going to be perfect. No one's ever going to find the perfect love, whatever that means. We know that's a fantasy. But what makes your book, okay, you want to figure this out for yourself? Come to the 8 Rules of Love.
Yes. So the 8 Rules of Love doesn't treat love as a ethereal, intangible, spiritual concept. Instead, I break down love as a set of habits, skills, and daily practices. So it's probably the most tactical, practical version of how to find love, keep love, and let it go, in that there are exercises, there are meditations, there are workshops, there are reflections. I wanted love to feel like something you could work towards, not something that you wish and want and hope will just magically manifest in your life. And some people would argue that that takes the magic out of it. And I would argue that, well, the magic hasn't worked so far. So it's important that we open ourselves up to this new view. The other thing I'd say is that all of my work ties together ancient wisdom, modern science, and then pop culture. And so when I write a book, when I take on any task, I look back into spiritual texts and wisdom texts that are over 5,000 years old, mm-hmm. and I try and extrapolate and excavate the truths. I then find the modern science that is parallel to some of those insights and challenges it. And so you can tell that everything's been researched and thought through. And then my job is to give you the strategies and the steps to actually put it forward in your life. And so the book really brings those three areas together. So that's what I would say makes 8 Rules of Love different. So, and by the way, I'm a big fan of other love books too. Like, I can name some of my favorite ones, like Modern Romance by Aziz is probably one of my favorite love mm-hmm. books. The 5 Love Languages, I believe, is a brilliant book about love. So I'm also a fan of this genre, and I want to point that out.
So let's talk about pop culture. Let's talk about Hollywood. Obviously, you're very popular in this town. But one of the things that people talk about love is Hollywood puts out this idea, this romance. I'm going to meet him on the top of the Empire State Building, and it's going to work. Is Hollywood just perpetuating this misery? I'm going to use misery in the end, because it perpetuates this fairy tale, this idea of, like you just said, that it's not magical, but where Hollywood says, you know what, it is magical.
Go ahead. Sorry, Mark.
Go ahead.
So love definitely has magic to it. I just think that the process to find it needs to be more thoughtful in the way that I present in 8 Rules of Love. I would say that where movies have misled us, music makes us feel heard. And so I think when you look at this town, like a lot of us, when we're going through a tough breakup or we're even in a fun, exciting part of a relationship, we can all remember the soundtrack to that relationship or the soundtrack that we listened to when we were broken up with. And so music kind of gives us this safe space of being heard. And so, but I agree with you. And I would say that I do think movies have misled us towards thinking that it's all magic, or that there isn't work and effort and energy that goes into it. And I think it comes from the famous statements of happily ever after, and how movies always end on the wedding day, or, you know, you finally find that person perfectly after many years. Now, all of those things are beautiful things about love that I believe in, that I value. I want people to have that kind of a love. This book is dedicated to helping you have that experience of love, but the journey to that love is very different. Right. And so while the end may be where we all want to be, I think the journey we take is different. And that's what I want to help people build genuinely, intentionally, and design in their lives. I think marketing and advertising, Mark, have even more to do with it. I give the example in the book about the idea of, I remember when I was proposing to my wife, I went up to a friend of mine and I asked him, like, I'm thinking of proposing, how do you do it? Like, what goes on? And he said to me, well, yeah, you got to get a ring and these are the best places to get it from. And I was like, okay, like a diamond ring, like how do I know it's a good diamond? And he was explaining it to me. And then I said, how much do I spend? I have no idea. And he said, you spend 2 to 3 months' salary. And I was like, all right, cool. Like, and I just took it as like face value, like, cool, that's a cool number. And that at least it made sense. Cause I was like, okay, 2 to 3 months of what I make. That's fine. I can figure that out. And then years later, I watched this advert on YouTube that I came across, and the advert is a De Beers commercial. And the De Beers commercial has this beautiful black and white silhouette of this woman. And the only thing you see is her sparkling diamond ring. And then at the end of it, it literally ends with the words, and everyone can Google this and watch this. And it says, what better way to spend 2 to 3 months' salary? And that advert is from like 30, 40 years ago. I forgot the date. And it's unbelievable because I'm thinking, wow, like that piece of marketing and advertising has lasted decades to impact a random guy in London who, by the way, doesn't know what De Beers is because they don't have a big presence in London. Right. So I look at that and I go, yes, we have had so many ideas about love formulaically presented to us that we've adopted. And this book is about finding the love you want to create, not the love that everyone's telling you to create, but what's the love of experience you want to have?
Well, I love how open you are about your proposal.
Yeah.
You basically said, I fucked up.
Yes, I did. I was lucky. I don't know how much you want me to tell. I'll tell the story if that's what you're asking for. But my wife, I'm lucky my wife said yes. And I look back and I often think about that. And I think, what was I thinking about? So like I said, I've always loved romance. I've always considered myself a romantic. I love Hollywood movies. So I'm totally swept up. And even more so, I love Bollywood as an Indian man. And Bollywood is even like Bollywood is Hollywood on steroids when it comes to romance. So you have like a string quartet that comes out from the trees. You have multiple outfit changes in one musical scene. Like everyone can sing in Bollywood. Now I can't sing, so I didn't try and sing, but I tried to recreate that. So for everyone who doesn't know, for my proposal, and I tell this story at the beginning of the book, for my proposal, I planned like a proposal extravaganza inspired by Instagram and everything else. And I took my wife for a long walk by the bank of the Thames. Randomly, when she was least expecting it, she was surprised with a bouquet of flowers from this group or troupe who happened to be an a cappella group who were fantastic, who sang Bruno Mars' Will You Marry Me beautifully and brilliantly, better than I ever could. I got down on one knee, proposed to her, asked her to marry me. This part was perfect. I'm very happy with what I said to her. She thankfully said yes. We sat down and had a dinner on the bank of the Thames. Now, here's the thing. I assumed that because of the romantic gesture I was doing, a restaurant would just let me have a table by the bank of the Thames, which I tried to finagle my way into having. Not only was it hard to get the table, it wasn't glamorous at all. The food I'd ordered came cold and not fully cooked because it was delivered from a vegan restaurant because my wife and I are both, I'm plant-based and she's vegan. And so we sat down to have this meal and it was cold. And now anyone who knows my wife will know this. If you don't know my wife, I'll tell you right now. My wife is a vegan recipe developer and lover of food. She's a dietitianist and a nutritionist. The number one thing that's important to her is food, and the food sucked. It wasn't the bad restaurant. It was just cold. Then we walked around the corner, and right around the corner, we had a horse-drawn carriage, a white horse-drawn carriage. It looked stunning. She was fully surprised. We jumped on the horse. Jumped on the carriage. We traveled around, and my wife, we're on this journey together. We get off on the other side. We get on a train to go back home. And all of a sudden, We start to notice something, but anyway, I'll save that. We get to her parents' home to tell them the good news. I'd already asked their permission. They knew what was going on. We go to see them. And the first thing they do when they open the door, they say to my wife, they say, "What happened to your face? Are you okay? What did he do to you?" Right? It was like, that was their reaction, because she had hives all over her face, like full of red boils and marks. That was the day I realized that my wife was allergic to horses, and I had no idea. And so all of that to say that I messed up the food. She got the allergic reaction. I messed up on the things that were most important to her. She still said yes and had a good time. She never complained. She never made a thing of it. But to me, it was a sign that it's been 10 years since we've been dating now. If I was to propose again this year, it would be so different. And that made me realize just how what I thought love looked like and what love truly is are two very different things. That proposal could have been anyone's proposal. Actually, I could make a business out of selling that proposal to other people.
Listening to it, you know, I'm laughing now. Obviously, I know this story beforehand, but I'm listening to it and you sound like a producer for The Bachelor.
Yeah, that was and I didn't even know what The Bachelor was when I planned it. So yeah, but that's exactly it, right? You're thinking that love has to be this extravagant, like this big, massive gesture of love. And my wife's response was, we could just literally, well now, because we live in America, obviously in LA, it's like, we could just go to Trader Joe's and you could buy me some bread. Like that would be her ideal date. And, you know, I always thought that everyone wanted this grand gesture, and my wife didn't.
So when do you start developing rom-coms? And seriously, like they're, you know, we don't want the fantasy taken away. You do want the magic, but are there scripts? Are there shows? Are there movies you want to develop that sort of go along with the 8 rules of love, but could also have some appeal?
Mark, I love how you think. I really love how you think. And I'm glad that you're taking the conversation in this direction. Absolutely. I love shows that are showing a real side to so much of what is happening behind the scenes. One of the shows that I absolutely love is Ted Lasso. And the reason why I love Ted Lasso so much is because even in the most positive, you know, person, you get to see the challenges that that person has internally. You get to see the mental health journey. You get to see behind the scenes. I think that for me, definitely, I would love for 8 Rules of Love to inspire shows that are based on the realities that come with trying to keep love and find love and lose love. And, you know, stop making people feel that they are going to bump into someone at a grocery store, or they are going to just miraculously end up with someone's number on their phone, or, you know, like you're going to be approached randomly by the perfect gentleman on the streets because you forgot something that fell behind. Like, I think it's about, and I think that's where television is going. I think that's where movies are going, because I think audiences are wiser. I think audiences are more informed. And audiences are looking to see themselves portrayed on screen more, as opposed to, not that it isn't an escape anymore, but they are seeing some reality to it. So absolutely, you're on the money.
So are you developing the 8 Rules of Love reality show?
Not yet. But definitely part of the plan.
So, like I said, I look at the back of the book: Jennifer Lopez, Shawn Mendes, you can't get any bigger superstars than that. Why are you resonating in this town where there is so much to sort of get through to try to resonate? Why are the Jennifer Lopez's, the Shawn Mendes's, the Gwyneth Paltrow's, the Selena Gomez's? Why do you resonate with them?
Mark, I should ask you that question. You know the town better than I do. I'll be honest, Mark, and say that I'm extremely humbled and grateful to know these people that I listened to growing up, or you know, watched growing up and appreciated growing up, and I'm very grateful to know them in a genuine way, and I really value my relationships with them. I think that I would hope that things resonate because they're coming from a deep intention to serve from my side. When I started doing what I do, I had no idea that it would ever reach where it's reached today. I had no plan for that. I was happy if I could have done this in my evenings and weekends because it was my passion and my heart. And so my hope is, my intention is that when I'm speaking, when I'm teaching, when I'm writing, when I'm coaching, I'm hoping that the heart of who I am and the work that I've done and the work I've dedicated to is what's resonating. And at the same time, I also consider myself to be, you know, I'm very fortunate to have a lot of different experiences. I was born and raised in London. I lived my monk life in India. I've lived in New York City and LA. Like, I feel like I have a very global view of the world. Mm-hmm. And I've also had very random and unique experiences that allow me to connect dots that otherwise are seemingly opposite and incoherent. And mm-hmm. I think I sit at a paradox where people are able to accept, like, oh, well, Jay can relate to me. And at the same time, he's involved in a deeper unknown world. And I think I enjoy and appreciate my ability to oscillate between these two worlds. And I think that people feel that I don't judge them. I don't criticize them. I don't think I'm better than anyone. I don't think that I'm wiser than anyone. I come at it from a place of humility and service. So I hope those are the things that resonate.
And talk about being of service. You officiate Jennifer and Ben. Listen, you're not going to tell me about your private discussions with them, and I would never expect you to do that. But you're standing there, like you said, like you didn't know this was going to be your life. You're standing there, Jennifer Lopez in front of you in a wedding dress, Ben Affleck in a tuxedo. You know, I'm old enough to be remember the first time around covering that as a reporter. What is going through your mind?
Great question. The first thing I'd say is that they both obviously looked outstanding. And what the first thing or the most, like the deepest, most cherished memory that I'll keep from that day is getting to see love up close. Mm-hmm. And I think I've officiated a few weddings. This was probably third or fourth now that I've officiated. And I feel as an officiant, you get to see love up close. And what mm-hmm. I mean by that is you get to see the trembling of the lips. You get to see the shaking of the hands. You get to see the tears that are just about to drop from the eyes. Like, to me, it's like time slowed down where I could really just observe these genuine expressions of love that don't come from what we say, but they come out of our body because it's such a physical experience. And so watching their lips quiver and their hands shake and the tears roll, like, that to me is what's going through my mind, is how beautiful it is to see true love up close. And I would say to everyone that if you ever get to see two people in love, just observe these very, you know, they're not holding each other. This is from this is standing, right, you know, like on either side, like the hands are not even touching. It's such an amazing experience. And to feel that energy and that electricity between two people who've waited so long for this moment, there's nothing like it. And so I would encourage everyone, when you're next at a wedding, look out for the small things. We get carried away by the decor and the grandeur of the event and the flowers. And it's like, well, forget all of those things and just observe these two people who are about to make vows and love each other. And that's what I'll remember, the moment when Jennifer walked down the aisle and Ben was fully emotional and just that complete presence and just that pure love and that they share with each other. So I hopefully that gives you enough of what I was experiencing that day. And then of course, actually the number one thing, Mark, that was going through my mind was don't cry, because I'm a full on crier. Wow. And I love love. I literally love love. And the whole time I was like, Jay, you have to hold it together because you've got to lead the ceremony. You can't start crying before the whole thing starts. And so the whole time I was like, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry. I was just talking myself down. So I had to like just pull myself together because I love love and every part of me just wanted to like sob full of love.
So what are your favorite romantic movies?
Oh, good question. All right. So an old classic that I got to, when I interviewed Matthew, I got to tell him I'm a big fan of How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. It has to be up there. I think I watched that movie with too many ex-girlfriends and it's still a great, I can still watch it today and enjoy it. And I think that's what makes it, it's such a good movie. I've always loved, He's Just Not That Into You. I think that was a movie that showed a fair bit of reality and truth in relationship. I think that movie carried it really well, obviously loved the entire cast. And the movie that I have a love-hate relationship with, and maybe this is unpopular opinion, but it's The Notebook. And I'll tell you why. It's a beautiful story, but there's moments in it that are so unhealthy. So there's this moment where Ryan Gosling's character, I forget his name. I can't remember his name, but Ryan Gosling's character goes up to Rachel McAdams' character and says, I'll be anything you want. I'll do anything you want. Like, I'll be whatever you want me to be. And I'm like, that's bad relationship advice. Please don't do this. And then there's another scene where he's literally hanging off a Ferris wheel. And he says to her, like, if you don't go on a date with me, I will let go. And, you know, those kind of things are extremely triggering today. Like if someone came up to you and says, hey, by the way, I'm gonna let go and potentially die if you don't go out with me. Like those are not healthy messages, but that's how love's been portrayed. And so that's the kind of stuff we want to take away from our conversations on love. And we want people to find that beautiful lifelong love.
I was just interviewing someone else about The Way We Were. That's one of my favorite romantic dramas.
Yes. Yes. Beautiful.
I feel like I can keep talking to you forever because we haven't even talked about solitude and loneliness and what, you know, and I love what you say in the book. It's, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm summarizing this incorrectly, like we need to be okay in our solitude.
Yes.
And that, to me, after I've been in love, after I've had a breakup, the solitude, I call it the loneliness, solitude is the better part, the better way of saying it. That's the toughest part. That's the
toughest part. We have to realize that there's a you before a relationship, a you during a relationship, yes, and a you after a relationship. And I think because we don't know who we are before a relationship, we lose ourselves in the relationship. And then when the relationship ends, we feel lost. And so it's a really interesting journey that we all go on. And it's natural to want to be with someone. But all the research shows, Mark, that if you get into a relationship because you're scared of being alone or you fear being alone, chances are three things happen. The first is you settle for less than you deserve. So when you're making a decision to be with someone because you feel alone, you actually lower your standards and you'll pretty much take anything. The second thing that happens is you become more dependent on them because more often than not, you feel, oh my God, I'm so lucky to have them. Without them, I'd be so incomplete. Oh my gosh, like I've got to hold on to them. So you feel dependent on them. And the third thing that happens is you actually can't break up with them even if it's unhealthy and toxic, because you think being alone is so bad. And so we make so many bad decisions in relationships. And I think we can all relate to these, me included. We make so many bad decisions in relationships because we're scared of being alone. And so what I recommend in this book is that we build a better relationship with ourselves by spending time alone, because what that does is it gives you a space of safety and security in who you are. Now, when you walk into a relationship, you know what you bring to the table. You know what you have to offer. You know what you're going to connect on. And now if things don't go the way you want them to go, you have something to not even just come back to, but go into.
And you have a foundation.
You have a foundation. But again, Mark, our language has misled us. Oh, they complete me. Oh, where's your better half? If someone's your better half, does that mean you're the worse half? Now you're left on your own as the worse half, or you're left alone, incomplete. And you know, even though I would say my wife is my better half in many ways, it's, I don't believe I'm a half. She's just an amazing human, but that doesn't make me any less than. And I think that if we're going to make someone feel superior, we have to feel inferior. And that incompleteness in ourselves and completeness in someone else actually weighs much worse on our self-esteem and self-worth. And so I don't want people to think that their self-worth is based on someone else's validation. So time alone gives you the space to define your own self-worth. There's a reason it's called self-worth, not other worth or their worth or partner's worth. And I think that's what solitude is for.
And should you watch The Notebook by yourself or make sure someone's there with you?
Exactly. Definitely watch it with yourself too. Watch it with yourself. Notice how different it is. So Mark, you just brought up something interesting. There's something called the context effect. And the context effect in psychology is the idea that they did a study where they found that if people hold warmer drinks on dates, they have warmer feelings towards each other. So there's a reason we ask people to go out for a coffee, because you're likely to have warmer feelings. And right. They did research on this. They also found that if someone walks out of a romantic comedy at a theater, you're thinking in your head, I'm going to cross eyes with someone and this could be special. Or we all feel we're going to fall in love at a wedding because love is all around. And so the context effect is really interesting. When you watch The Notebook with someone, you think we're going to be together forever because we watched this movie together. So got to be very careful with the context effect. Right.
My last question for you, what is love?
So I think there are so many beautiful definitions of love. And as I promised to do in this book, I promise to be your friend, to be honest with you, and to guide you transparently in what it truly is, not mislead you. I define love as three things. Love is when you like someone's personality, when you respect their values, and when you're committed to helping them achieve their goals. And when that person is willing to do those three things for you too. That is love. And if you look at love through that definition, you will very clearly and quickly figure out whether you have a long-term future with someone. I had someone the other day say to me, Jay, I'm getting married. What's your advice for me? And I said, tell me your favorite things about your partner's personality. And what I found is the answers are very vague. They're kind. They're generous. And I was like, you can pretty much say that about everyone. I said, do you respect their values? What are their key values? They said family. I was like, that's pretty broad too. What about their family do they value? Right. And then I said, what are their goals over the next 3 years, 1 year, 5 years? And they said, I'm not really sure. And I was like, well, that's where you want to start, because when you marry someone, it's not about, or even if you have a relationship with someone, even if you don't get married, you don't experience the chemistry. You experience the compatibility, the character, and the connection. That's what you experience. Mm. And everything starts with chemistry, but it has to evolve into compatibility and character and connection. And so if you don't know anything about compatibility, character, and connection, then you're just relying on one of the four parts of love.
Jay, this was awesome.
Thank you, Mark. That was so much fun. That was so much fun. And I appreciate the direction you took it in. I hope I did justice to your audience. And I'm so grateful for your support. And I hope we bump into each other a lot more.
Me too. Me too. Go have a beautiful Thursday. Thank you for this pep talk. And I'm just going to go try to find someone to run into and fall in love with.
I love it, Mark. I love it. Well, three places. Look for people of value, people that have similar values that you think know those people. Do projects of similar value and go to places of similar value. I know so many more people that have found someone working at a charity or a soup kitchen, working on a cycling club or a sports club that they love, or through a person that is good friends with both. Those are the three most amazing ways I've seen people meet recently. So I wish you all the best, and awesome. Wish everyone listening all the best with love as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Bye.
Take care. Bye, Mark.
That was Jay Shetty. Now I'm going to take a short break, but when we return, Fleabag and spoiler alert actor Ben Aldridge opens up about coming out as gay and starring as Jonathan Groff's husband in M. Night Shyamalan's new thriller, Knock at the Cabin. Welcome back to Just for Variety. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. TV audiences first took notice of Ben Aldridge in Fleabag. Then, just a few months ago, he broke our hearts as entertainment journalist Michael Asiello's late husband, Kit Cowan, in Spoiler Alert. Now, he's back on the big screen in M. Night Shyamalan's Knock at the Cabin. Aldridge and Jonathan Groff play husbands whose vacation in the woods with their young daughter takes a horrifically tragic turn when their house is invaded by four very violent strangers. I talked to Aldridge from London as he was getting ready to fly to the U.S. for the New York premiere of Knock at the Cabin. We talked about singing with Groff, coming out at age 34, his favorite drag queens, he even reveals his own drag name.
Hey!
There he is.
How you doing?
Good, how are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Nice to see you.
Good to see you. How are you?
Yeah, good. I'm good. Yeah. Done a day of this, but it's been really nice to talk about the film and saw it last night with an audience, which was fun.
What time is it there where you are now?
It is 5:50, so it's early for you, right?
It's 9:50 a.m.
Oh, yes, that's nice.
Yeah, it's a perfect time. I was saying earlier, it's when some of these interviews happen and it's like someone in Australia and it's like, Nicole Kidman could talk to you at 3 a.m. I'm like, it's Nicole Kidman. I'll get up at 3 a.m.
We'll do it. You're not going to say no, are you?
No, I'm not going to say no. So I saw the movie last night.
Right.
And I was scared to come home. Even though I don't live in a cabin in the woods, I do live by myself on the ground floor. There are a lot of windows.
Right, yeah.
So thanks for that.
Fearful for that home invasion moment.
So let's start off, because obviously this is the kind of film where there could be potential spoilers and, you know, we don't want to ruin it for anyone. So when someone says to you, tell me what the film's about, what do you say?
I say it is a, I've got to give you the pitch, right?
Yeah, so give me the pitch.
It's a family that are given the ultimatum of saving themselves or saving humanity.
But there's a knock on the cabin.
There's a knock on the cabin. Yeah. Did you not like the pitch?
It was good.
You want more of an outline.
Yeah. Like what kind of, so you and Jonathan Groff are a couple, you have your daughter and you're in a cabin in the woods.
Yeah.
Is, you know, the setting for a great thriller always.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden someone is knocking on your door.
Knocking on our door, yeah, and it's a home invasion, almost straightforward home invasion horror film, but with you know, obviously devastating ramifications for the family at the center of it, but actually like global devastating ramifications outside of that family, and it's like this as like with a lot of his films, it's a runaway train, like the stakes start here, and it is completely relentless. Mm-hmm. It was relentless to read, it was relentless to make, and it feels like, yeah, it's so interesting. He's like Knight's like a lightning rod for audience reactions and press reactions, I think. And there's been something nail biting about every step of the process, and now there's something nail biting about kind of like releasing that into the world as well, which is almost as nail biting as making it.
When you filmed it, did you film it in sequence? Like, was filming going with what was going on in my heart and me white knuckling it the whole time.
Yeah, absolutely. We filmed all of the flashback stuff in the first 3 days, and everything else we shot pretty much in chronological order. So, and most of the flashback stuff is kind of are the only bits of levity in the entire piece. Yeah. So we kind of like got that out of the way, and then just like, yeah, then it was like jumping on board this like runaway train, and the shooting in chronological order really, really helped because of the way it ramps up and the way it's kind of incremental. It would be really hard to shoot this out of sequence, I think. Also, given that we were so often in that same location, and like you could probably kind of get quite confused and lost in it. But I was really, when he said that he was shooting it mostly in chronology, I was like, I was very, very pleased. But yeah, nothing is ever, I've never been as affected by a film as I was by this in terms of, I've been emotionally affected by stuff, and like, spoiler alert, I found incredibly emotionally affecting, but this was like the fear of it, it got kind of like got inside my body, the tension, playing that level of tension and committing and feeling so fiercely protective and in love with the family and just like fighting for our lives. That was just like, it was tiring. It was overwhelming to do that every day for 8 weeks. And be tied to a chair every day for like 8 weeks as well. It was pretty intense. It was incredibly intense.
What's incredible, at the end of the movie, I wrote in my notes, I'm like, no wardrobe change, really. You wore the same outfit. Because it's one, if I'm correct, it's just one day.
Yeah, it's set over 2 days actually. Okay. Yeah, they sleep overnight in the chairs at one point, yeah.
Right. So yeah. You didn't have to do much wardrobe change. How many of those t-shirts did you have?
Millions. So many of those t-shirts. So many of that pair of shorts. An endless amount of doubles for those things. Yeah. So what are you saying? It was an easy task?
This is a really easy job for you because you didn't
have to. He doesn't have to do any costume changes. How easy? It's not Drag Race.
So someone wants to do Drag Race. Celebrity Drag
someone
Race.
Did.
Okay, I'm going to ask you, what's your drag name, Ben?
Oh, my drag name is Sue Blime.
Sue Blime. Oh, yeah. Wow. So you've thought about this. That was...
Yeah, Sue Blime.
And what's Sue Blime like, Ben?
I haven't. She hasn't been out in drag yet, so I don't know. I'm not sure, but I'm up for discovering. But yeah, Sublime. What would yours be?
You know, I don't know if I've actually. I always do that. You know, it's like the street you grew up on and your dog's name.
Yeah.
But then that would have been like 85th Street PJ. I mean, which makes no sense.
No, it hasn't got the ring to it.
Yeah. I feel like I just would want to be called girl.
Girl is really good.
It's girl.
Because with Sue Blime, I'm quite into the idea of just being called Sue. I think that's quite a funny name for a
because it's such a name.
Just such a name, such a regular name. But Sue Blime is the full name.
Okay. I'm going to get back to Drag Race in a minute.
Okay.
Were you familiar with the novel that the movie is based on?
No, I wasn't. Knight had obviously I wasn't even allowed to read a script before he had decided he wanted me to play it. So I had three scenes to do an audition tape with
that weren't part of the movie. That aren't
which were part of the movie, but I had no context for.
Wow.
The only thing I had in the email was that Dave Bautista was attached to be in it. So I made the audition tape. A week later, I did a Zoom with Knight. It was probably about an hour and 45 minutes of like working the scenes. He wouldn't give me any more information about the film. He would give me a bit more information about the character, but he was like, you don't need more information about the film. And, but he also just really wanted to get to know me as a person. I think he's very fastidious about the chemistry, the group chemistry and who he's putting with who. And he really wants to know someone, I think, before he puts them in the film. And then so 3 days after doing the Zoom with him, I got a phone call from him, which is obviously really unusual because it didn't come from an agent. It just came, I was like, M. Night Shyamalan's calling me. And he said, I'd like to make this film. I'd like you to come on the journey of making this film with me, with his words. And I was like, cool, right. What is the film? And he said, I'm going to send you a link. It expires in 24 hours. So you have 24 hours in which to click on the link. Once you've clicked on the link, you have 6 hours to read it, and then the link will explode.
What is this, Mission Impossible?
Literally Mission Impossible. And he was like, and then let me know if you want to do the film. Obviously, I was already like, I'm not gonna say no to M. Night Shyamalan. But I was curious. I didn't know like the size of the part. I didn't know the thrust of the story arc. And I was so gripped, but also like very daunted, very intimidated by it. Like as it was unfolding, I've genuinely never read anything so violent and so shocking. And like when I started reading about the cloth white bags they were putting on their heads and the weapons are very detailed in the script, I was like, what is this? It's so dark. Like, what is going on? And then I was kind of reading the arc and like how much Andrew is like fighting and denying, and he is the cynic, and I was like, oh, this is going to involve so much acting. It's going to be intense. It's going to be relentless. And by the time I got to that final scene between Andrew and Eric and the choice that Andrew has to make, having believed the antithesis of it for the entire film and then turning on a dime and having to pull, well, wait, we won't do spoilers, but having to make the choice that he has to make without fully having faith in that choice. I was so intimidated by that scene. From the moment I read it, I was like, how am I gonna do this? And even when we started on day one, knowing that we're filming it chronologically, I just had so much fear around getting to that scene, partly because I didn't want to have to go through it, but also like, I was like, whoa, how am I gonna play all of that? Yeah, but the whole thing was kind of scary.
I mean, it's hard to, we can't really talk about this because it is a spoiler, but
yeah,
but I walked out of the movie going, okay, what choice would I make?
It's right,
excuse my French, but it is fucked up.
Yes, it is.
Choose that.
Yeah.
So did you have a chemistry read on Zoom or in person with Jonathan? I mean,
no, we didn't. I think Knight just said that he was sure that it would work between Jonathan and I, and we'd never met. I've long been aware of him. I was first aware of him when I was 21, graduating drama school, because I auditioned for a year. I did 12 auditions to play Melchior, his part in Spring Awakening. So when I was 21, I was listening to Jonathan sing Spring Awakening all the time because he was teaching me the music just by listening to him. And so he's always been someone, I didn't get the part. It's like the thing that's actually genuinely one of the things I've been most upset about, not in terms of not getting something, probably the thing I was most upset about my whole career was Spring Awakening. I fell in love with that show. We did a workshop of it. They had two casts, actually, and for this week's workshop, which was the final audition week, we learned the entire thing, performed it, and then they cherry-picked their people from the two casts. We were basically competing. We were competing for the, like, directly competing in front of each other. Oh. And I didn't get it, which is...
Was
which
this
is
for, it. Like, a West End production? What was it for?
Yeah, it was for the West End transfer of Michael Mayer's, exactly the same production.
Wow.
So I'd always been aware of him, and then Looking was one of my favourite TV shows. And yeah, kind of, I've just, you know, I think he's fun. I think he's such a good actor, and there aren't many people who bridge the gap between musical theater and film and screen work that he does. I think he's in quite a rare position where he's respected in all three of those mediums as well. And yeah, so it was a real, like, I was really excited to kind of get to work with him. And fortunately, we just became really fast friends. We had a 2-week rehearsal period and in which we were like encouraged by Knight to bond with Kristen. And so I think being around an 8-year-old and being part of it, I'd never been part of like a kind of family dynamic with another man before. Like, it was quite an interesting thing. I don't think I want children myself, but I was like, oh, this is, and I don't know, spending so much time around a kid, I think it just makes you more like open and playful and childlike yourself. And we just all had so much fun. And she's like one of the most charming, disarming, sassy, spicy little people in the world. Her first movie, wow. Knight was really coaching her and teaching her how to act. She'd never acted before. And we were kind of relearning about acting ourselves. Me and Jonathan were like, oh yeah, no, that's how we should. All right, you know, and yeah, it was just a really nice 2 weeks preparation before the film, and we became this like little family unit. We still have she's an incredible texter for an 8-year-old, and we have a text conversation with her. She is just really funny, and I think she's like, how did you think she was good in the film?
She was incredible. I mean, the opening of the film, just you're captivated. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, she's like, she's stealing those scenes off me left, right, and center, which is really annoying.
He actually just booked Spring Awakening. No.
Oh, yeah, she's playing Jonathan's plot. She's playing Melchior.
So you do a little singing with Jonathan in the movie.
Yes.
Was that always part of the script, or was it like, okay, he sings, you obviously sing, you got to get the two gay guys singing together?
There was, I think there was a mention that like they sing along, but not to the extent that we sang, like chucking in the harmonies and stuff. And I remember the first time I'd sang in front of him was it was very early on in filming, and Knight had thrown a dinner for all of us at his house. And we were on our way back in the car with Kristen and Kristen's mom and Abby and Nikki. And Kristen was like, let's do karaoke. So she put on a Frozen song, and she made Jonathan sing a Frozen song. And then she sang a song herself. And then she said that I had to sing My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion. And I was nervous to sing in front of Jonathan Groff, I have to say. I was like, and also My Heart Will Go On, but I committed to it because an 8-year-old's asking me to do it. And so that was my first like embarrassing moment, I think, singing that in front of him. 2 days later, she turned to me really randomly on set in between a take. And she just said, and she always called us by our character name. So she was like, Daddy Andrew, when you sang, I felt embarrassed. I was like, excuse me? Are you feeling okay? But she loved being mean to me. That was kind of like her, I know, can you believe it? I was like, she's shamed me. And she picked the song for me as well. She was like, you sound like a girl. I was like, well, I was being Celine Dion. I was giving my best sublime gaze.
I was just going to ask you, could you give me a little Celine Dion, but as sublime?
No, not yet. I'm going to have to workshop that for you and get back to you with it.
Listen, this is a gay couple at the heart, literally the heart of this movie.
Mm.
You came out publicly not even 3 years ago. Spoiler alert. Yeah. A knock at the cabin, playing these full, what's the word I'm looking for? These fully realized, these gay men, queer men who are not sidekicks, are not supporting. Did you ever, when you were coming out privately or professionally, think that this would be a part of your career trajectory?
No, never. Never in my wildest dreams. And it kind of makes me emotional to think about it, really. Like I left drama school closeted. Acting for me early on was very much about, could I convince, even though I knew I was gay and wasn't acting upon it, like I was preoccupied with, could I convince playing straight roles? Mm. And if my 20s were like proving that to myself, which feels a slightly shameful thing to look back on, actually, because I don't blame myself for it, but there's some real shame involved in that, you know, that concept of many years ago, if someone might have said to you, "Oh, I wouldn't know you were gay," you might have felt some kind of validation from that, and it's actually a disgusting thing to reckon that might have been the way you felt. But I'm sure you can probably relate to that as well. And it's the same in my acting roles. I was kind of proud of myself for getting cast as these romantic straight parts, and I was enjoying escaping myself as well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then the real privilege of this kind of like turn of events, and when I decided to come out or claim my identity just under 3 years ago, I actually did it. It was more with a calculated risk that I thought it might impact what I get to do. But my authenticity and my truth about who I was felt more important to me. Felt more important to me to claim that than to hide behind anything for the sake of my career. And if people didn't want to work with me because I was gay, or they wanted to stop casting me, then I wasn't interested in working with those people either. But what I didn't predict and what I was surprised by is that it seemed to coincide with a kind of more queer filmmaking, TV making, more queer content being made, and also coincided with this interesting debate. We've a very hot topic of like, do we cast authentically? Do we have to make a rule for that? I don't personally think we do have to make a rule. I think that's a dangerous kind of path to go down. But yeah, it's led to this like really liberating, empowering, emboldening, exploration of myself in my work that I didn't think I would ever do. I've learned about myself. I've invested in my work in a way that I never have before. I care about it so much. I've always cared so much about acting, but I feel like the skin between me and something I'm playing is so thin now. And that it's given me an access to a kind of emotional depth that I truly in my 20s, I was kind of challenged to find that, I think, because there was something slightly robotic in me, maybe some kind of protective layer, in having not come out and not having fully realized myself, that I didn't have access to all of myself. Mm. And now now playing these parts, it feels so significant, and I feel so privileged. And I was gonna say proud, but I feel proud to be gay, but I don't take pride in myself in terms of, I feel proud to be a part of the project, but I just feel really grateful that I'm riding a wave of progress, and that these stories are, these people, these men are at the heart of the stories I'm being asked to be part of telling. And I'm really proud of Spoiler Alert for what it is, and the fact that it is about a relationship, it's about a gay relationship, and it's a love story, and all that encompasses its ups and downs and its trials and tribulations. And then I'm really pleased and gladdened by Knock at the Cabin and the way that Knight has handled that queer couple, is that he kind of normalizes it. It's about a loving family. It could have been any loving family. And their gayness is part of the story. It's not integral to the story. He manages to honor our experience in these flashbacks through hardly any words. He makes it really relatable. The scene with the parents, the scene with the homophobia, they're short moments. But what they do is they honor something that I think a lot of us as gay men can relate to. And it's not what the whole film is about. The film is about this loving family, and that's at the center of it. And I don't know, I think it's progressive in that way, you know? It's a studio-backed genre film, and it doesn't comment on that. It doesn't, you know, so much of kind of a bit of a bugbear of mine is that when a gay film is made, a mainstream gay film is made at the moment, it ends up explaining what being gay is so that it has mass appeal to a potential straight ticket buying audience. It kind of goes like, if you didn't know what gay is, this is what gay is. And it's like, we don't need it to do that. That's not progression. That's kind of weirdly backwards. And I like that Knight didn't feel he had to do that. He doesn't comment on it himself. And he was obsessed with love. when mm-hmm. making this film. He would say to me, particularly me, before the intense scenes, I mean, every scene's intense, but he'd say, think about how much you love Eric and Wen. It was all about this family unit, you know? And I found that that was really inspiring. It was really inspiring to work on that. He never had a conversation about, he didn't make it feel special or different. Mm-hmm. He just made it feel real. And that's kind of cool. But it's a very long answer to your question in that, I'm really, really grateful to be part of telling the stories that I'm part of.
Tell me about the moment you hit post on that Instagram. What went through your head?
Oh, you're gonna make me cry. It sounds dramatic, but I could just breathe easier. I underestimated how significant that was to me. I really did. I kind of thought, it's not that I played it down, but I didn't know what it would kind of like do to me physically. And just for days afterwards, I was like, I needed that so badly. I wasn't aware of how much I needed to do that and how much I'd potentially hung on to, conveniently hidden behind. It just felt, I felt so powerful to be able to like stand alongside and be part of my community. And I didn't do it with many words either. Like I didn't want a big explanation. I just wanted something simple. The road to Pride had been a long one for me, and it really had been. And I felt truly, truly proud. And it had taken until that point to really feel that, but I just felt lighter. I felt I could breathe easier.
I love that you're talking about breathing, because that's what it's about. When we, you know, I know you know some of my story, and, you know, when I came out as HIV positive or came out as, you know, a crystal meth addict in recovery, I didn't realize how much, when I wasn't sharing that, how much I wasn't breathing.
Yeah, because you're holding on to something.
You're physically holding on emotionally, which affects you physically. And what I always say, especially in recovery, and I know it's not, coming out of recovery is not the same as coming out as gay, but in the sense of when I say to someone, I'm in recovery, my shoulders go down.
Right. Yeah.
And that's what it is. You know, I talk about this a lot about Kristen Stewart. When she came out as gay, Kristen was always like this.
Yeah. Posture changed.
Like that.
Yeah.
And that's from breathing.
Yeah. And I suppose I completely relate to that. And you know what I was saying about like, I suddenly had access to myself in a way that I, not only was I like holding myself from other people, I was holding myself from myself. Yeah. And I suddenly realized that I had held myself from desires that I had. I didn't know that I loved Drag Race. I'd forgotten, or I denied to myself really early on, I love musicals. I love divas, but I hadn't let myself love that stuff. I wasn't even conscious that I was holding myself back from me. And like, so yeah, I could breathe, but also I was suddenly like, whoa, there's all this stuff that I haven't allowed myself, I want to get to know. And I'm still there really. And it feels like quite a strange, unique position to be doing that in my work, and then to be discussing in interviews like this. You know, if you've held on for something all your life because of shame, it's been an incredibly private thing. And then you are, not that I think that people are taking notice, but you are willing to stand up in such a public arena and explore that. It's like, yeah, I would just say my skin feels really thin.
Okay, so who are your favorite divas? Let's see.
Oh, who are my favorite divas? Barbara Streisand.
Ben, done. We're done. This interview's over. That was fine. That was right. You Googled me. You Googled me. No, you didn't. Let me tell you, Ben. I did a podcast with Barbara. What we're doing now, but it was only audio, not... I'm going to send you the link.
Oh, my goodness, dude. Wow.
Barbara.
Yeah. And do you know what? That's like that, her, for example, was someone who, like, I always knew that she was a diva. And my dad, actually, who is straight, loves her. But I was always a bit, I was aware that she was a gay icon. So I was a bit like, ooh. Yeah. And it really only, even recently, I'm like, wow, Barbara Streisand.
Yeah.
Like, I watched the way we were.
But Ben, stop. We're not going to talk anymore.
I watched it for the first time recently, and I was like,
the first. Okay, now you're definitely gay. But a bad gay.
Yes, bad gay. I'm making up for it, though. I'm trying.
The way we were.
Yeah.
Literally, the hello and goodbye scene at the end, I could cry.
I was just, that is my same. That, I was talking to Jonathan about that. That scene. I was like, and you know that they love each other and they don't say it. And I watched that and I was like, I am determined, if I still love someone, you know, after you've been with someone, I think you will always love them in some kind of intimate way. Like, I will just say it. Life's too short. Like, not when they're standing there with their new wife, but I just think it's a kindness to let someone know that you, yeah, that I just found that scene just like.
Oh, that movie is just.
Yeah. And she's extraordinary in it.
Oh, she's extraordinary in anything she does.
Yeah.
Okay, Ben, you're going to do the gay version of The Way We Were. Who's your other leading man?
Jonathan Groff. I'd have to just do a rehash. Is that okay?
You know what? That works.
He's giving you Robert Redford.
Oh,
obviously,
you're Barbara.
Oh, yeah. I am Barbara for sure. Well,
I got my last question for you since we went there. Who's your favorite Drag Race star?
Whoa, that is. Can I choose one for like? Oh, that's tough. Do you know, I think it might be Alaska.
That's not a bad one.
No, I know. I'm not saying it's bad. I just think it's going back a bit, but I just think Alaska, those vintage seasons were amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I love, I don't know if you've watched We're Here.
Yeah, it's so good.
Oh.
It's so great.
Talk about changing lives.
Yeah, and also... It's really, the production values of it are so good as well. Like the way it's shot, it's so tender as well. Yeah.
That was Ben Aldridge. And that's it for this week's Just for Variety. Thanks for listening. Until next time, make sure to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Mark Malkin. And for all breaking and exclusive Hollywood news, go to variety.com. See you next time.